Our next speaker is Dr. Haff from the University of Michigan. He's really a world expert in ECMO and is heavily involved with the ELSO organization, helping to lead it. And he's going to speak to us about post-cardiotomy ECMO support, but also at the end, I think, mention a few things about some of the recent CMS changes in ECMO reimbursement, which are quite relevant to our field.
Thanks, Matt. Thanks. Well, thank you, Dr. Paquetta, and thanks to the American College for inviting me to speak. So these first two talks were impressive in some of those really amazing cases that they demonstrated. I will be much less impressive in talking about the area of interest of mine, which is cardiac surgery and post-cardiotomy support. So we're talking about use of ECMO for a pump problem, for a systolic dysfunction of the left ventricle, using mechanical blood pumps. And I think it's important to recognize that mechanical blood pumps come in two different flavors. There are the pumps that are designed for short-term support, like the ones we use in ECMO, and then there are the pumps that we call durable pumps used for LVADs. And I know that this is off-topic, but I have 20 minutes, so I was going to talk for about 2 minutes on the durable VADs because there's something about it which is timely. The first of the durable VADs that was introduced was the HeartMate device that you can see pictured here. It's this big, clunky, pulsatile pump that would sit in the belly and go from the LV apex to the ascending aorta. These are the data in bridge to transplant patients. These are patients who are listed for transplant but are dwindling in the ICU on inotropes and balloon pumps and swans and so forth. And you can see the overwhelming survival advantage for those patients who received the durable LVAD. And then, of course, this is the rematch data. These are a comparative trial of patients that are ineligible for transplant, basically old people, who had end-stage heart failure, and they were randomized to receive pills or to receive the pump. And you can see, again, overwhelming survival advantage for those who received the pump, however short-lived, because all the patients were dead after 2 years because the pump wasn't very durable. It didn't last more than a couple of years, which really brings us to the more modern era of LVAD support. This is the HeartMate 2 and the HeartWare pump. These are continuous flow pumps that basically never break. There has never been an end-of-life mechanical failure of any of these pumps. They are quite durable. And these pumps are designed for long-term ambulatory support. So this cool cat sitting here had his pump implanted 11 and a half years ago, still doing very, very well, has more frequent flyer miles than I do, active, gratifying life. And you can see lots of other patients doing all sorts of other silly things on LVAD support. This is probably ill-advised. But anyways, that's the design of these pumps, is long-term support. This is the latest device that is now available. It's the HeartMate 3, not a very interesting name, but the idea is that the rotor is magnetically levitated with large gaps around it, and it has pulsatile or phasic flow, and the idea is that this pump is designed to have improved blood handling characteristics, and we believe will therefore improve hemocompatibility and reduce the incidence of what we consider to be hemocompatibility-induced adverse events. And here is the clinical trial, which was published in the New England Journal just a couple months ago. It was a randomized trial of the HeartMate 2 and the HeartMate 3 pump, and I'm going to point out three specific hemocompatibility adverse events. The first is pump thrombosis, clotting of the pump, which occurred in 12% of the HeartMate 2 patients. 12% of the HeartMate 2 patients and goose-egged in the HeartMate 3. So we think that that problem is solved. Stroke thromboembolic complications occurred in 19% of the HeartMate 2 patients over the course of 2 years, and in the HeartMate 3 patients, only 10%. So cutting the stroke rate in half, and in fact, a stroke rate of 10% over 2 years is the lowest stroke rate in any LVAD clinical trial, so very encouraging. And then the last hemocompatibility adverse event is gastrointestinal bleeding. So for those of you not in the VAD business, GI bleeding is very common in VAD patients. It's a combination of being on Coumadin, having acquired von Willebrand factor dysfunction from the shear forces of the VAD, and third is having a non-pulsatile flow from these continuous flow pumps and the formation of gastrointestinal arteriovenous malformations. And what we found was, disappointingly, there was no difference in the frequency of GI bleeding events that required transfusions, hospitalizations, and endoscopy, about a third of patients in both arms. But nonetheless, two out of the three major adverse events are significantly improved with this new pump. These are data from Intermax. These are the number of VAD implants in the United States, and you can see it's rising quite rapidly. And this is all related to HeartMate 2 and heart wear, but then you notice it's flattening out, right? So the growth of VAD seems to have plateaued, and we believe the reason it plateaued was because of these adverse events. We think that it was slowing down the referral base because cardiologists didn't want to send their patients to have a stroke, to have pump thrombosis, or hospitalized for GI bleeding. So we believe now that we've significantly reduced these adverse events that this curve is going to start going up again. I should also note that the HeartMate 3 was approved for use on Monday of this week. So literally 48 hours ago, this device was now approved, and the clinical trials are now closed. So we're here to talk about shock. And so what is the role of these kinds of devices, these durable devices, in the treatment of shock? So when we evaluate a patient for LVAD, we categorize the patient using what's called an Intermax score, Intermax profile, and it's a somewhat subjective assessment by the surgeon on how sick the patient is, and it's in decreasing order of acuity. So Intermax profile 5, 6, and 7, these are basically outpatients. These are people you see in the office with heart failure, and you have conversations with them about having a VAD to improve their quality of life. The higher Intermax scores are obviously sicker patients. So Intermax 3 are patients that are inotrope dependent, and Intermax 2 are patients inotrope dependent, but they're declining. These are people who are probably not going to make it through the weekend if you don't do something. Intermax 1 is what we would call critical cardiogenic shock. These are people at imminent risk of death. If you don't do something to support them, they are going to die within a period of hours. And so what is the role of VAD in the Intermax 1? And for the most part, it's frowned upon because the results are obviously not as good. So in the VAD community, we try to take Intermax Class 1 patients and optimize them using temporary mechanical support to see if perhaps they can become a candidate for durable VAD, becoming less ill. In addition, a lot of the patients in your own hospitals who are in cardiogenic shock, they're not candidates for LVADs, right? Some of these patients just have comorbidities or have social issues that are going to preclude their ability to get a durable VAD at all. And so durable VADs would not be an option for them. And of course, many patients that are in cardiogenic shock don't need a VAD because their heart may recover. They may have myocardial recovery from whatever it is that caused their cardiac dysfunction, whether it be trauma, like we discussed before, sepsis, acute MIs, and so forth. So durable VAD is not for everybody in shock. And so what is for people in shock? Again, it's a temporary mechanical support. Now, we're here to talk about ECMO, but ECMO is just one of the tools. I know Maurer used the term toolbox. So in your tool belt, ECMO is one of those tools, but there's lots of different things that can be used for the treatment of shock, and I'll touch on a few of them in my talk. Now, when we apply temporary support to patients in shock, I like to think of them in three different bubbles. The first bubble is post-cardiotomy support, which is actually what I'm supposed to be talking about. This is my 8-minute introduction to my topic. Post-cardiotomy support is one population. Another population will be acute onset heart failure patients. So these are people who did not have cardiac surgery and did not have long-standing heart failure. Most of these will be acute MIs, but some of them myocarditis, maybe even septic shock, massive PEs. And then the last bubble will be people with long-standing chronic heart failure who develop decompensation, exacerbations of heart failure, and progress to shock. So these three different populations are very different from each other. The physicians who manage them are very different, and your mode of treatment may also be very different. We're going to focus today on this post-cardiotomy group. Now, regardless of the patient population that you're treating, whenever you enter the world of temporary support, you really have to be thinking about an exit strategy, right? Where are we going from here? So bridge, we use bridge analogy a lot in medicine. This is the Mackinac Bridge in my home state of Michigan that spans the upper and the lower peninsula of Michigan. It's not really the best analogy for temporary mechanical support. This is really the analogy for temporary mechanical support. And when you get into this space, obviously you want to master the skill of how do you get across this bridge. And what I would tell you is the skill that you also need to acquire is how do you see across that bridge, right? What are we bridging this patient to? So is this a patient in shock that we're bridging to myocardial recovery? Is this somebody that we think the heart will get better, either with revascularization or with time, with heparin and so forth? Or is this a patient that we know the heart is dead, we're going to be bridging this patient to long-term cardiac replacement, either in the form of heart transplantation or these durable VADs that I mentioned before. And as I also mentioned before, there are lots of people who are just not candidates for this sort of stuff. And so you want to be able to very quickly evaluate a patient in fulminant cardiogenic shock and say, what's on the other side of this bridge here, right? Is there an option of bridge to recovery? Is this situation consistent with the potential for recovery? Or if we know that this is an unsalvageable heart, which oftentimes you do, is the patient ever going to be a candidate for implantable VAD or transplant? And if the answer is no, then my advice is don't be like this person stuck on the middle of the bridge with no place to go. This is a snapshot of post-cardiotomy support. I'm sorry, the paper is a decade old, but it is sort of a classic paper. Looking at the Society of Thoracic Surgeons database, which has hundreds of thousands of case records within the database, and the frequency of post-cardiotomy shock defined as the need for short-term mechanical replacement. The overall incidence was 0.3%. So again, the minority of patients who have cardiac surgery develop this situation. And if you look here at the mortality rate, it's quite high. You can see somewhere around 50% mortality. So it's really a very morbid condition. There's also a suggestion from this paper that outcomes are getting better, that mortality went from 60% in the first period of this decade to 40% later on. I have a paper that's going to refute that in a minute. Now, I told you about the different tools in our tool belt, and the first of these is the Abiomed pump. And there's nobody on the panel has ever seen this pump because it hasn't been around for a decade, but I see some gray hairs in the audience, and some of you may be familiar with the Abiomed pump. It certainly was the workhorse for post-cardiotomy shock for several decades in cardiac surgery. It was the only thing available. And while it did have its limitations, there are thousands of patients that are alive today because of this pump. It's an extracorporeal, pneumatically driven, air-driven pump with these polyurethane valves. This pump would be attached directly to the cardiac chambers. I stole this slide from Lou Samuels, basically showing that you're really only limited by the creativity of the surgeon in terms of how to cannulate the patient to use this type of pump. Here's the paper from 1993 showing the success of the device. So in 31 patients, you can see if you applied the device in patients before they suffered cardiac arrest, you had about a 50% survival. But lo and behold, if you waited too long, whoops, the survival was extremely poor. It's funny how we're still writing the exact same paper, but with different devices today. So brilliant. So that device is no longer available. We're now using largely the Centromag, which is a magnetically levitated centrifugal pump. It has very nice blood handling characteristics and reduced thrombogenicity. Same basic concept, applying it directly to the heart. Here's the clinical trial published 6 years ago, showing basically survival is about 50%. So survival is really not a lot better now than 15 years ago with the predicate device. However, some of the adverse events related to hemoincompatibility are improved. This is the Impella device. I can't imagine people in the audience don't know what it is. If you watch television, you see the advertisements for it. It is a microaxial blood pump designed to be transvalvular. So you can insert it into the vascular system. You place it across the aortic valve. It sucks blood from within the left ventricle. There is a impeller that you'll see here in the inset that spins at about 50,000 revolutions per minute, and it throws that blood out into the ascending aorta, therefore bypassing the weakened left ventricular function. There's a family, we'll turn that off. There's a family of these different pumps of different sizes and flow capabilities, and it can be inserted peripherally, it can be inserted centrally. In the cartoon, you can see insertion directly into the ascending aorta for a post-cardiotomy failure setting. Here is a clinical trial, very small clinical trial, 16 patients with post-cardiotomy shock. You can see the improvement of hemodynamics when the device is applied. And look here at the survival rate, 93%. I just showed you large database series with 50% survival, other clinical trials, other VADs, 50% survival, all of a sudden a new device and 93% survival. It's not the device, the patient selection here. The entry criteria were really quite soft, which was the reason why most of these patients survived. But nonetheless, it is one of the tools that we can use. And then, of course, there's ECMO. We've already heard from the other speakers about what ECMO is, and I will just point out that ECMO is actually not a product. ECMO is an application. It's an application of devices that were designed for other purposes to be used as an ECMO tool. And basically, ECMO is a pump and an oxygenator, and that's all it is. And by comparison, this is a cardiopulmonary bypass system right here. So ECMO is a modification of this. So where is ECMO in this picture? Well, ECMO is right here. ECMO is the pump and the oxygenator, and that's it. And all the rest of this in cardiopulmonary bypass, whoops, sorry. How do I get back to this? Great. So ECMO, again, is a modification of cardiopulmonary bypass, simplifying this circuit, and most importantly, eliminating the interface between blood and air. That's what allows you to support the patient for days or weeks. I told you ECMO is not a product, and that's not exactly true. Here is an ECMO product, the CardioHelp system from McKay. It is not FDA approved as an ECMO device. It's approved for 6 hours of support, so we use it off-label. Now, in terms of the timing of post-cardiotomy support, your patient fails to wean from cardiopulmonary bypass. When do you make the decision to initiate ECMO support? And this is a classic paper from 20 years ago by Lou Samuels that I'm sure is exactly the same today. So in his series, patients that weaned off cardiopulmonary bypass on 3 high-dose inotropes, right, coming off on rocket fuel, this patient is going to die. 80% mortality. They're either going to die that night of malignant arrhythmia, or they're going to die in 3 weeks of multisystem organ dysfunction. So clearly, if you're in this situation right here, you need to make a decision. Is this patient going to be a candidate for durable support? And if so, do it fast before you have irreversible complications. This was a paper that we wrote a few years ago on transfer patients in post-cardiotomy shock. Had cardiac surgery elsewhere and then transferred to us in shock. And what were the predictors of death? Kidney dysfunction and lactate levels, and these are markers of delayed intervention, allowing the patients to wallow in low output before we initiated temporary support. So it really is about the timing. And not being judgmental, what are the reasons for the delay in initiation? The reason is because these cardiac operations are typically emergent. They're done at inconvenient times. They're done at night. They're long, complicated operations. So lots of things are telling the surgeon, we really just get out of the room, right? Just come off on rocket fuel. There's lots of bleeding in these cases, and obviously ECMO is not going to improve your bleeding. It's going to make your bleeding worse. And then certainly for centers out in the community that don't sort of have this longitudinal exposure to patients on mechanical support, they don't really know which patients are candidates or which patients are not. So they just put them on rocket fuel and send them and let us decide. So these barriers do exist. Here's a great paper from Bud Frazier from a few years ago looking at post-cardiotomy initiation of support either immediately in the operating room or leaving the OR in rocket fuel and then employing it a day or two later. And you can see survival goes from 70% down to 17%. So timing is really the key. Now, in terms of cannulation of these patients, there's a lot of different approaches. The simplest approach is just leave the same cannulas that you use for cardiopulmonary bypass in the ascending aorta and in the right atrium. And then you just leave the cannulas in, you switch from bypass to ECMO, you slap some Ioban over the chest, and you drop them off in the ICU. Simplest way to do it, it's a little on the messy side, but you know, you didn't create the mess, you're just trying to deal with it. Here's it's an unpublished paper I'll reference in a minute, but fancy ways of cannulating through the chest, but allowing you to tunnel it either through the suprasternal notch or subxiphoid, so you have to decannulate and recannulate to allow the tunneling process. It makes it a lot neater because you can close the chest, but takes a little thought and creativity. You can use the groin. You guys are all good at that, percutaneous insertion in the groin, and works very well. I would make a point, though, about limb ischemia. It's very, very common. In this series, it was 20% of patients that had significant limb ischemia. And why do the legs get ischemic? Well, obviously because you got a big hose in there, but it's also because of the vasoconstriction, right? So these people are all in shock, and this is what your femoral vessels look like when you're vasoconstricted, right? Completely obstructed. This is a 6-French catheter in there, so your iliac artery is the same size as your LAD because of the amount of norepi and vasopressin and all the other stuff that you're on. So you have to salvage the limb. You have to provide support for the leg, legmo, to keep the leg alive. Now, another strategy is instead of cannulating the leg, you can put a graft on it, the so-called stovepipe, and it looks nice and neat and pretty, and it does work quite well if you want to put the time into doing it. You could do what Matt Paquetta has been a champion of for a long time, which is staying away from the dirty groin and using the axillary artery and the jugular vein. So in theory, your patients can be up and walking around is a good approach. So I just told you there's a whole bunch of different ways you can cannulate the patient. So if you ask 10 different cardiac surgeons, how do you cannulate, you're going to get 10 different opinions. And why is that? Because we don't have data. Well, now we have data. This is hot off the press. In fact, it's not even hot off the press because it's not in press yet. It is to be published from Roberto LaRusso and colleagues. So a meta-analysis of central versus peripheral cannulation. So he has this nice table, and I'll go through it one by one. No, I'm just kidding. So basically, these are the pros and cons of every different cannulation strategy. And you can see there's a lot of pros and a lot of cons. This is why you get 10 different opinions from surgeons. And so what are the outcomes? Here are the outcomes. Exactly the same, right? It doesn't make a difference, which is why surgeons are completely convicted that their way is the right way, because it works for them. So, and then again, if you look at any of the other specific endpoints, secondary endpoints, it's all the same. So cannulate how you want to cannulate. But since I have the microphone, I'm going to tell you how I cannulate. My personal philosophy in post-cardiotomy shock is that the majority of these patients are going to declare their survivability within the first 48 hours. So you're not cannulating them for the long haul. You're cannulating them for 48 hours, right? You're just trying to let the dust settle and figure out who's going to live and who's not going to live. And then, so I want to make it as efficient as possible. Maximize flow and minimize the complexity in the time. Then in 48 hours, again, a lot of these people are going to be declared and probably go to heaven. But the ones that are viable, I take them back to the operating room, you wash them out, and then you make a decision. Some of them are actually going to come off ECMO fairly quickly. You may be able to decannulate at that 48-hour mark. And those that you think you do need to support them for the long haul, then I'll get creative and think about other options to cannulate, like maybe axillary approaches or tunneling the cannulas out so the patients maybe could have their chest closed. Venting is something that we have to think about. You have to remember that when you're on VA ECMO, you are not on full bypass. There is still some blood that is making it to the left side of the heart, and that blood must be ejected by the left ventricle. If the LV is so impaired that it cannot eject that blood, the LV is going to distend, and you are going to end up with pulmonary edema, and your likelihood of myocardial recovery is going to be significantly reduced, again, if that LV is severely distended. So you have to decide if you need to vent. There's a lot of different ways that you can vent in the post-cardiotomy setting by putting cannulas directly into the left side of the heart. The right superior pulmonary vein is our standard approach. You could use the dome of the left atrium. You could use the LV apex. Some advocate using the pulmonary artery. I don't think that's really a vent, but many people do it. You can ask the LV to vent itself. You could put a balloon pump in, and by reducing afterload, that LV might in fact eject and therefore prevent distension. Or you could use the Impella. You could mechanically suck the blood right out of the LV and vent it in that strategy. So I told you why you should vent, and is there any reason why you shouldn't vent? Well, here's one reason. If you completely empty the left side of the heart of blood, you're going to have stasis in the LV outflow tract and stasis in the aortic root, and this is what can happen. You can see complete thrombosis of the LV outflow tract and of the aortic root. And then the other reason for those advocates of early Impella use is really expensive. You're adding an extra $30,000 to your ECMO bill, and we'll talk about the finances in just a second. So venting is a very, very debatable subject in the ECMO world, and here is just an editorial by Danielle Camboni from Regensburg, who basically says, we never vent. 2% of our patients get vented, and our results are great, totally unnecessary. And then, of course, the other side, Roberto LaRusso from Maastricht says, you really should be venting. It's super important. It makes all this sense, but the reality is we still don't know who needs to be vented. So it is an important point of discussion. Anticoagulation, very briefly, we all know that on ECMO, you're balancing bleeding risks from clotting risks. And what I would say in the early post-cardiotomy setting, and you think of that balance, it's all bleeding and less clotting, right? And so we tend to reverse all anticoagulation initially when you go on ECMO. We don't start the anticoagulation until the bleeding stops. So we've heard from the other speakers, you can get away with that for a period of time. And certainly I would rather deal with the clotting issues than deal with exsanguinating bleeding in the post-cardiotomy setting. And how do you monitor anticoagulation? Nobody knows. Every center does it differently. No evidence to support one strategy or another. In terms of outcomes, post-cardiotomy shock, this is a paper that is quoted most frequently from a few years ago out of the group in Leipzig. 500 post-cardiotomy cases, survival was about 25%. But what I'll point out here is that if you make it out of the hospital, long-term survival is pretty good. So as one of my faculty mentors told me, if you do all right, you'll do okay. It's wise. And then if you look at independent predictors of survival, some of them are obvious. Age and Euroscore is a composite risk predictor. But then some of them were a little funny, like if you're a smoker, you're more likely to live than if you were a non-smoker. Not sure why that is in Germany. And then if you look at ECMO techniques, we talked about timing. And for those people that did not go on ECMO immediately, how long from your original operation until you went on ECMO was a powerful predictor of mortality. Glenn Whitman from Hopkins wrote this nice editorial about post-cardiotomy ECMO treatment. And there's a couple of important points. Number one is explosion, just like the other speakers, showing that the use of ECMO in this application is also on the rise. However, survival rate seems to be trending down. Why is that? So we think we're using it more because technology is improving, but our outcomes certainly are not getting any better. And why is that? So Glenn pontificates that, number one, we don't have a standard definition of who needs it. And number two, we're not really collecting data to find out who is benefiting from it. So he proposed that in the STS registry, we start collecting all of these data to determine which patients really are futile. He also references this paper, an analysis of ECMO usage using the national inpatient sample. And down on the bottom, they talk about the cost or hospital charges for ECMO use. And look at these big numbers here. Hospital charges of $300,000, $400,000, $500,000 for ECMO cases with 20 and 30% survival rates. We're spending a lot of money on dying patients. And you think, well, we're just doing our best to help somebody out. Well, guess what? Somebody is noticing. So as Matt alluded to at the beginning, CMS this year has made a coverage decision to change how we get reimbursed for ECMO. So historically, all cases of ECMO, no matter what the indication for ECMO, was assigned a PCS code that you see here and DRG-003. And the average Medicare payout for DRG-003 was about $100,000. Now you may say, well, you know, we don't put a lot of Medicare patients on ECMO because, you know, it's elderly people. But guess what? We all know private insurance tends to follow within 6 months and 1 year to replicate whatever CMS codes are. So this does matter to you. This is going to have a huge impact on your hospital bottom line. So what did they do? So CMS created three new PCS codes specifically attached to the mode of cannulation. CMS decided that how you cannulate is going to determine the cost of care, which of course we in the ECMO world knows is ludicrous. And so if you are centrally cannulated, you continue to have MS-DRG-003. If you're peripherally cannulated for VA ECMO, you fall into the same category as cardiogenic shock with major complications. Your hospital payout is $7,000. That's not a mistake, $7,000. That's not even the cost of your cannulas and a couple days of antibiotics. For VV ECMO, you are now assigned to DRG-870, which gives you a payout of $35,000. So these are dramatic and draconian reductions in hospital payout. Again, this decision was made earlier this year and enacted October 1st. So it is live. You're getting paid less. So fortunately, professional societies are on this. So I'm part of the group from ELSO that's partnered with the Society of Thoracic Surgeons. And this minute, this very moment, a letter that these two organizations have produced is now circulating through all of our professional societies, including this professional society. We are hoping for the endorsement of many of these societies, including the College of Chest Physicians, the American College of Cardiology, the Academy of Pediatrics, and probably about a dozen others. And that letter will be submitted to CMS in the hopes of reversing what we think was an inappropriate change. So ending my talk on a bit of a sour note, but I think it certainly will leave it open for discussion. So thank you for your attention. Sorry for going a little over.
Okay, we can open up to the mic.
Is that Impella pump that you implant, is it totally implantable, or does it have to be connected to something outside the body?
No, the Impella pump is a temporary pump, which is, yes, it is connected externally, and it is a hospital ICU-based pump. It is approved, I think 6 days maybe is what the FDA approval is for. It's for, you know, intermediate duration of time.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Dr. Half, can you discuss your timing of placing the LV vent?
When do you put an LV vent in?
Yeah.
When you need it.
Yeah.
So I tend to be less aggressive with LV venting. Mm-hmm. So most of the time, you know, the LV is impaired because the patient is in shock and the lactate is, you know, 14 and your pH is, you know, 7 points low and your coronary flow is low. And so when you go on ECMO, you restore perfusion, your vasoconstrictors come down, your pH normalizes. I have found that the majority of the time the LV starts to eject, so I tend to be a little more patient and wait. And if you're convinced then that the LV is not going to eject, then I will vent them. The caveat to that, though, is in patients with longstanding heart failure, where my goal is bridging them to LVAD, to durable LVAD, lung pulmonary edema is going to be a barrier. I'm not going to put a durable LVAD if the person's drowning. So in those patients, I may be a little bit earlier at putting an LV vent in, because I just want to get that patient optimized and get an LVAD in them as soon as possible. Does that answer your question?
Sort of. What's the latest in open chest scenario? Let's say you're 2 days out, your acid base is correcting, your lactate's coming down 7-ish or so. Still don't, you have a little bit of LV ejection, not yet enough time to recover post-emergent CABG. Centrally cannulated, you didn't leave a vent at the time when you left the OR. Still don't know, you know, how the LV is going to recover.
Yeah, I mean, in that setting, I would only put an LV vent in if I felt like the LV was distended, if I had a Swan in that mm-hmm. showed high PA pressure, something to suggest that LV was distending. Mm-hmm. And if I didn't have that, I wouldn't put a vent in. And if after 2 days, I'd go back to the OR, and if I didn't think that heart was going to come off then, which it, you know, may not be ready yet, then I would probably recannulate that patient with something more creative, either tunneling them out through the chest or axillary or maybe a cut down on the groin, and then give the patient another week. Unless, of course, you know, it was a young person that I really thought maybe VAD was going to be a better option. And then I may leave central cannulas in and just give it another couple of days and then just go to durable VAD.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Dave Underhill, Hartford, Connecticut. I thought that the presentations were spectacular. You guys did a great job. One thing I would say, we have a pretty active ECMO program, and we've instituted a ECMO on the go program. We've done 47 patients so far. And this speaks more to the first lecture. This is a civilian group of patients. And we fly out to the referring institution in a helicopter, put the patient on ECMO, and then transport them back via ground transportation, so we avoid the transportation in the air. We found that to be quite good, and our survivorship is 67%. You had said that there are no contraindications to ECMO, and we would tend to agree with that. One thing we've been exploring recently is the end tidal CO2, and when that's less than 20, we've had absolutely no survivors. So we use this with our ECPR patients as well as our other referral patients. I wondered if you could comment on that.
Thank you for your question. Yeah, for the ECPR, for sure. I think the Annapolis sort of group described that pretty well with the end-tidal CO2. We haven't looked at that at all, frankly, for our VV ECMO transports. We don't really record it. It's half the time I feel like we don't have capnography. We have pretty rudimentary ambulances, even though we're in the military. We haven't looked at that.
Would that warrant a change to a hybrid configuration if you went on and you initially saw very low end tidal?
Good. I mean, it depends what their echo looked like, I would say.
Dr. Heft?
Tell me the question again. And we don't use end-tidal CO2 as a marker. We use lactate levels for ECPR as a cutoff, but we only use that if you're over the age of 65. So if you're under 65, doesn't matter what your lactate is, we're going to give it a go. But if you're over 65 and your lactates are over 20, then we punt. But we don't use end-tidals. I want to ask about this transport. So great results. A smaller, newer ECMO program is going out to retrieve and fetch these patients, which is fantastic. Huge amount of work and a huge amount of time may not, you know, all be reimbursed. You know, you're flying out. I mean, the costs associated are huge, but you're saving people that probably would be unsalvageable. We're in this business too, but only for respiratory failure cases. We don't do it for cardiac support. Is anybody going out to retrieve
you know, cardiac failure patients. I've always found that, you know, too often you get there and they're dead. And so anyways, what do you guys think?
Well, we do. I think you have to be very careful about your selection criteria. And the last thing you want to do is initiate a very expensive, time-consuming transport for a patient who is essentially dead on arrival. So I think one thing that we've been working on is trying to develop relationships with the hospitals that refer these types of patients with us so that we have a little bit better sense of the indications and have been able to provide feedback. I think when you first get into that game, you could end up with a lot of mistakes, and you have to really drill down on that. I think this also goes to the point that you, as well as the other panelists, have made about the timing of initiation. And a classic example of this occurred a few months ago where a patient was basically, should have probably been put on ECMO about 20 hours sooner, and by the time we got there, there was, you know, clearly a mistake to go. But I also think with the CMS changes coming down, it's going to change a lot of behavior about, you know, people are going to become a lot more risk averse. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays on our indications.
I just want to echo one thing you said and contrast something you said. So in regards to VA ECMO, which we did a reasonable amount of, it was always with an established relationship, a hospital. So it wasn't ever a cold call because, like you said, half the time you get there and the patient's dead and it just wasn't what was sold to you. Whereas if you have a relationship and you know the group, you typically, you know, can go. And we were pretty strict, I have to say. They had to be pretty young and have a pretty good chance of getting better if we went out there to do it. For VV, we actually were really excited at the beginning and I think did a fair amount and then realized it's just such a tremendous resource drain. That we honestly really pushed all of our efforts towards education of timely referral and actually found that that was by far the easier and in efficient. Our efficient yeah. route to take. And with that, we actually had zero deaths in transport for cannulation at our institution. So we moved towards the, just put them in an ambulance, put them in a helicopter, get them over here, we'll get them on the second they get there. And the time to ECMO, actually, we analyzed was significantly shorter than it was if we went out there and put them on.
Dr. Hale, do you want to tell us about your experience in Hartford?
So of our 47 patients that we've gone out and fetched and brought back to Hartford Hospital, I think that we are seeing a trend, just like you are, to VV ECMO. But we will take any patients, VA or VV. I think in our last 20 patients, the majority of them have been VV ECMO, although I can think of at least three or four that were VA. We have a two-physician discussion on the phone when we get a call, either in-house or out-of-house. And both physicians have to agree that the patient's a candidate. So it gets into your exit strategy that you were talking about. And one of the physicians is an internist. Jason Gluck is our medical director of ECMO, and I'm the surgical director. This also goes, by the way, for cardiopulmonary bypass salvage. The surgeon can't just automatically say, oh, I can't get this patient off a pump and I'm on three pressors and so therefore I'm going to put him on ECMO. They have to call a consult just like everybody else. We go to the operating room, usually it's me, and we discuss the case and then I'll make a phone call to Jason and we hash it out and decide whether or not the patient's going to get it or not. And I think you're right on that in 48 hours, if they haven't declared themselves one way or the other, they're just pretty unlikely that they're going to survive. That's with VA. I think that one thing that hasn't been said, we take a portable echo machine with us to these outside hospitals and we do our own echo at the bedside before we even think about inserting a cannula. This helps us decide whether they need VA or VV ECMO. It also is a useful tool for us in our own ICU to help us decide whether that heart's going to recover. And I think this gets into the question that the young doctor was asking at the other microphone. We would use an ECMO machine in that situation to decide whether this was a salvageable heart or not. And if we thought it was, then we would give a lot more credibility to venting that ventricle. I think that's one of the real Achilles heels of ECMO, is it doesn't protect the ventricle well when you're going for salvage and recovery of the heart.
I would just say that it depends on how you cannulate, because if you vent the LV, you can actually get good decompression on an ECMO circuit. The other thing I would say, it's admirable that you take an echo machine to do that. I think that you also have to be aware that once you start to improve the oxygenation in a patient, that heart can sometimes actually perk up quite a bit.
Yeah.
There was somebody who was going to ask a question back there, but let's go with you, since you're still standing.
Thank you.
We'll see if he stands up again.
Congratulations for your excellent speech for the panel. I'm a general surgeon, Harry Miller from San Diego. I have no idea in ECMO. It's my first time I come to see something like this, and it's fascinating. Maybe I'll ask a couple of weird questions that are not maybe right to ask. One would be, how often do you get sepsis? Because we have old catheters around the patients, and is it very common to get infections in the sites where we put the catheters? That would be the first question. And the second question is, and it could be weird, I don't know if it's possible or is it contraindicated, with ECMO, is it possible to use hyperbaric oxygenation, or would it make it worse?
Okay, I'll ask Dr. Half to talk about the ELSO database with respect to infection in the cannulas. I think we all have our own experience by institution. You want to just give a sort of a global what's reported, or
nope.
You want to talk about your own?
I don't know, to be honest with you, I don't remember what the ELSO registry reports as far as cannula-induced sepsis. What I would say is it does happen more commonly in VV ECMO because the respiratory patients are supported for a longer period of time. Cardiac ECMO, patients are on for far less because either they're bridged to recovery within a week or they're bridged to durable VAD or they don't survive. And so, VV ECMO, it's not uncommon to have patients on for 14 days, 20 days, and then obviously they're at risk of catheter-associated infections.
Dr. Biscotti, in your experience? Go ahead.
We actually, I don't know if you were talking about the same patient with the hyperbaric. There was recently a diver in Guam who had the bends, essentially got transferred to San Diego.
Yeah.
And we were consulted for ECMO. He ultimately didn't need it, but doing a quick lit church dive on it, the Japanese have done it a few times where they've placed them on ECMO almost immediately and then dove them for up to 72 hours. And so they've used hyperbarics and ECMO with success.
This does this help better oxygenation of the tissues? Does it help to get the patient quicker back, or is it the same?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this patient had bilateral pneumothoraces, which is really the indication for ECMO, and then then diving them obviously helped oxygenate the rest of the tissues, reducing that microbubble sort of issue.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
We have a question.
Yeah, how you doing? I'm Andrea, future CT fellow, so very educational for me. Thank you very much. Question to Dr. Hath, kind of what's your cutoff for leaving the operating room on ECMO for your post-cardiotomy patients? Is it two ionotropic agents, definitely three, sometimes one? Where do you make that delineation?
You're talking about drips?
Then actually leaving on ECMO.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you're on two high-dose inotropes and you're still struggling, you're still having saggy blood pressure and low cardiac indices, yeah, that's when I think it's time to do something. And you have options. It doesn't always have to be ECMO. You could put in, especially if it's RV failure. When patients have isolated RV failure, then I think the best thing to do is put an RVAD in, because then you really don't have to worry about systemic issues. But if it's LV failure or biventricular failure, then I tend to favor ECMO versus putting in a short-term LVAD, just because it's so common that when you have LV failure, that you're going to have RV failure. So if you're on two high-dose inotropes and struggling and adding that third drip, then I think it's time. But you also, as you're making this decision, you're also thinking, where am I going? Is this... is this somebody who's appropriate for durable VAD?
So if it's a, you know, an 82-year-old redo triple valve, you'd have to think very carefully about your conversation with that patient in the clinic, your conversation with the family members, and if you felt like this patient and this family would want extreme measures of support, then I would offer them ECMO, but I would have them on a very short timeline. You know, I would say if we don't see signs of recovery in, you know, 3, 4, 5 days, then it would be most appropriate to terminate support so you don't have a situation where a patient's, you know, in the ICU, futile, supported for weeks and weeks. As you know, you won't die on ECMO until you turn it off. So that is an issue. But anyways, for me, two high-dose inotropes and still struggling, that's when mechanical support, I think, should really come into the conversation.
Thank you. Also, you showed some numbers with the new changes in CMS. It looks like reimbursement is differentiated based on cannulation technique.
Correct.
Do you see an increase in one cannulation technique over another due to reimbursement?
Well, I mean, you hope not. You hope we're making decisions based on what's right for the patient, not based on how you're going to get paid. But, you know, we are, boys will be boys, right? And people will do stuff that, will reflect other means. But anyways, ELSO and other professional societies are hoping to reverse this. We think that the data, that there was no data presented to CMS when they made this decision. So they came to the conclusion that patients that are centrally cannulated are sicker and are more complex to manage. And we clearly have unequivocal data from the ELSO registry with tens of thousands of patients that show peripherally cannulated patients are just as sick and they are just as costly to care for as patients that are centrally cannulated. And those data will be presented to CMS, I hope with the endorsement of about a dozen professional societies.
Thank you very much.
One question for the panel. Is there a role in septic shock?
I think in kids, probably, in the pediatric literature, I think there's at least reasonable data. I personally don't think in adults it works all that well.
As the ranking pediatric surgeon up here, we do use it fairly frequently in kids, although it's certainly more challenging than pure respiratory failure.
We've had success with patients that have had septic shock and, you know, the associated myocardial depression of sepsis. It's a, you know, potentially reversible problem. I have no objection to putting somebody with, you know, fulminant, streptococcal sepsis on ECMO as a short-term bridge. I mean, the idea is that you're putting them on VA ECMO because the sepsis has caused cardiac dysfunction. When you have somebody who is septic and has a blood pressure in the toilet on maximal vasoconstrictors, but they have, you know, normal left ventricular function, I'm not really sure that ECMO is adding a lot. But for the patient with myocardial depression from sepsis, yeah, why not?
Yeah, and I agree. And that's a common question when you have VV ECMO patients and your intensivist asks, why don't you put them on VA? They're in shock, septic shock. If they're myocardial depression, then yes. But if not, then I think you're going to chase your tail.
We have a question.
Hi there, I'm Lauren Gordon from Toronto. I'm a vascular surgery resident, and in Toronto we see a lot of ischemic complications from VA ECMO, from peripheral cannulation. I was just wondering if you could comment on the role of antegrade perfusion cannulas.
What size cannulas are you usually using there?
I'm not on the ECMO team, so I'm not entirely sure what size cannulas we're using, but generally they do tend to be occlusive.
What size hole do you have to fix when you take them out?
Yes, that's the next question.
Yeah, so we do use large size cannulas. So I think definitely 26 French, I think.
It's probably the venous cannula.
Does that make sense?
The venous is probably, yeah. There was a study a couple of years ago that demonstrated actually you could have very good resuscitation with smaller cannulas. I think there's still a lot of shops that use very large cannulas, and I think it also depends upon what you're trying to do, if it's an ECPR case versus a full support case. But Jonathan, I think that...
It was your paper that said small cannulas, right? Well, Columbia. Columbia showed that a 15 French cannula fits everybody, no matter how big, just put in a 15.
I want you to know we also use 14 now where I am.
I showed you that angiography of the leg.
Mm-hmm.
And if you put a 12 French cannula in, the leg is still going to be ischemic, right? Mm-hmm. Because they're so vasoconstricted. So what I would say
is
that anybody
that's
percutaneously cannulated in the limb is going to be at high risk of limb ischemia. And at our center, everybody gets a reperfusion cannula. Everybody gets LEGMO. We don't wait and watch the leg because you're going to miss it and be disappointed. Everybody gets a leg perfusion cannula, and it's either antegrade or retrograde. We either, you know, put it in the SFA going down, or we put it in the posterior tibial going up. But everybody gets it in our center.
And then leading to a next question, because it is so frequent with peripheral cannulation, do you guys have protocols for monitoring for limb ischemia postoperatively?
And so the champion of that was Hiroshi, I forgot his last name, in Jefferson, wrote a nice paper on using NIRS spectroscopy on the feet, foot sats. So we don't monitor it because I perfuse it, and then you just monitor it with capillary refill and color and temperature and such. Mm-hmm. But if you're not going to put one in and you're going to watch and wait, then I think using clinical tools, you're going to be disappointed, right? Because you put somebody on ECMO, and what does the foot look like? It's mottled and cold because the patient's in shock. And by the time, you know, that tends to resolve, it's 4 or 5 hours later, and then you notice, oh, the leg I cannulated is still blue and mottled, and the other leg is pink and warm, and it's too late at that point. You're going to have, compartment syndrome and such. And so you have to make the decision right away.
We're on opposite ends here, and so I'll tell you that we actually are very selective about who we do the distal perfusion cannula on. We actually do use tissue monitors, and that's what really drives our decision making. We ultrasound all the vessels before we cannulate to have some sense of the size of the vessel and the risk for potential ischemia. Now, if it really looks like it's a high risk case, then we just go ahead and do the distal perfusion catheter. But otherwise, we allow tissue monitoring to guide our decision making. And that's a continuous 24/7 monitoring.
Thanks so much.
Question? Comment.
We follow the same protocol that Dr. Half does at the University of Michigan. We cannulate everybody with a peripheral cannula. It's an 8-French antegrade catheter into the SFA, following the recommendations of Columbia. And we've been very, very happy. We also use NIR spectroscopy.
Having come from Columbia, I can tell you that's not necessarily the recommendation. We actually use a tissue perfusion, and that's what guides our decision-making in 2018.
Yeah,
I would say that approximately less than 20% of those patients will often need that. So the other thing I wanted to ask, the question about volume resuscitation for these patients. If you put somebody on ECMO, does that change the volume resuscitation requirements?
In regards to what? Like a patient in shock?
Yeah. Do you think that you should be less aggressive? That's for the two of you right there. I mean, do you think you can be less aggressive with the resuscitation?
I would say no. I mean, I would treat them like my every other patient. So I'll caveat this with I'm a cardiothoracic surgeon, so I will always be less aggressive with volume than anyone else. But yeah, I think the answer is yes, right? So when you're not on support, you're using blood pressure and a couple other surrogates for perfusion, but really all you care about is perfusion, not how much volume per se the patient has in their body. So here you have a machine telling you exactly how many liters per minute you're delivering to those tissues. So I think if you have an adequate index flow for that patient, you can be a lot more conservative and, you know, maintain an adequate mean arterial pressure with that, knowing you have good perfusion. And actually, I would say we are extremely aggressive with diuresis as soon as they're on, based on that.
Okay. Well, I think we've run out of time, and thank everyone for attending. And I thank our panelists. Thank you.
Oh, yeah.